Welcome, Greek U Nations, episode number 378 of the Fraternity Foodie Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Ilon, CEO of Greek University. I am a speaker and an author. Our third book is called From Letters to Leaders, Leveraging Your Fraternity or Sorority Experience to Land Your Dream Job. So go and pick up that book today on Amazon. We call these books the Fraternity Foodie Podcast because there is nothing like great food to bring college students together. Fun fact, one of my favorite spots to visit in Amsterdam was Anne Frank's home. The Anne Frank House was established in 1957 in cooperation with Anne Frank's father. His name was Otto Frank, and now they run an independent nonprofit that runs a museum in the house where Anne Frank went into hiding during the Holocaust to try to increase awareness of Anne's life story all over the world. So if you are planning on heading to Amsterdam at any time in the future, if you've never been there before, go and check out the Anne Frank home today. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about this topic of concentration camps on the podcast today. And the one that we're going to talk about today on the podcast is one that you might not be aware of. And I think it's really important for the college students to understand what happened in order to prevent, to make sure that these types of things don't repeat themselves in the future. So today we are going to be talking to John Suzuki. John believes that we all have three careers. First, to learn and go to school. Second, to earn and make a living. And third, to return and give back. Now, in his third career of giving back, John's mission is to make the world better by inspiring people to live with less fear and divisiveness and bring a little more love into the world. John's skills include inspirational speaking, storytelling, problem solving, technology, evangelism, sales and marketing, and relationship building. His authentic and sincere spirit and caring for people are always appreciated by those around him. He's happily married for nearly 40 years, and John and his wife split their time between Seattle and San Diego, two beautiful cities where their children and grandkids live. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, Michael, thank you for inviting me. I can't imagine a better place to be at this very moment.
Absolutely. I agree with you. The only place to be
Totally.
is the Fraternity Foodie
Exactly.
Podcast. So, I really love your story, and you have so much great information and history to share with our college students. I think it's always fun when we get to talk a little bit more about history, US history, certainly. And you had 40 years of professional experience in technology sales, public
Yes.
speaking, business evangelism. Now you're starting to give back and you want more happiness in people's lives. So why do you believe that this third stage in life is actually to give back to others?
I think it's hugely, hugely important. You talked a little bit about the Anne Frank home. Older people have done a lot of things, and my personal feeling is that I've lived 62 years. That's a blessing. If anybody gets a chance to live 62 years, you're obligated to give back, in my humble opinion, in any way you can. I believe that we all share a common purpose, and that is to make the world better than the day we landed on it by loving one another, and because I believe that lifting people lifts the world. And the things that we're going to talk about, it's interesting, Michael, because you talked about my background and everything, and now we're going, and in a minute we're going to devolve into a kick-ass war story, right? And people are going to go, what are you talking about? But anyway, for me, it's about teaching. I realized in my career that the best advice that I ever got were from people who have been there and done that. And a really, really good friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, once told me, he says, John, I could care less about your opinion, but I'll listen to your experiences all day long. And so the idea is to help people learn, help young people learn so that they, if you can shortcut, life's lessons to them and teach them things that they don't learn in school. To help them really to make the world better and lift one another. I think that's what the third career for me is all about.
Yeah, that's what this podcast is all about, is really
Right.
giving them those lessons, those life lessons that maybe you didn't learn in school. And what we're going to talk about today is certainly one of those areas, I think, that we just didn't spend enough time on to really
Yeah.
understand what happened and how do
Yeah.
we prevent something like that from happening in the future. And I think what I want to talk to you about is really the dangers of a broken country, because you know, right now there's so much divisiveness. There's so much bucketizing of America at the moment. You know, you just look at the political parties, and it's almost like we're not even listening to each other. Talk about the dangers of this broken country.
It's hugely dangerous. You know, I mean, when there used to be a time when we used to listen to each other, right, and have debate and, you know, open minds. Now, and it all starts in Washington, D.C., right? It's your way, it's my way or the highway. And that is going to divide us. I mean, that's what happened that caused a civil war. And so a broken country can really lead to bad things. Honestly, you talk about the divisiveness and the bucketizing, right? I mean, you look around, we're bucketizing everybody. We got the white bucket, the blacks bucket, the gays bucket, the straights bucket, the Muslim bucket. We got all these buckets. And people have to realize, and I'm so happy. And again, I'm so grateful that you invited me here, because the young people of the world are going to be our future leaders, and they're going to own the world and be responsible for it. And so, you know, when you look back on what we're going to talk about in World War II, it was fear. It was fear. And it's the bucketizing of people combined with widespread fear, which led to the American concentration camps of World War II to begin with. And so people ask me, they say, well, you know, I mean, that was back then. We're living in a different world. Can it happen again? It already has since then. And you think about the recipe of disaster being bucketizing people and widespread fear. Think back on 9/11. Someone came up with a wonderful idea, misguided totally, that all Muslims were terrorists and needed to be rounded up and put in concentration camps. Fortunately, calmer heads prevailed. You look at what's happening, what happened in COVID even more recently with the Chinese issue, where people were blaming the Chinese. I mean, people in the United States were being attacked, right? Because somebody felt that they were to blame for COVID. We got to bring people together, and we have to bring people together, because absent bringing people together and educating them and helping them learn about what's happened in the past, we have to do that, or else it's going to happen again.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. And what's interesting and fascinating from my viewpoint, of course, is that fraternities and sororities really started in the United States because of debate, because the students at that time, if you go back to the origin of fraternities and sororities, the reason why they were created is because they weren't being allowed to have debate about certain topics on college campuses. So what did they do? They formed groups and started talking about it off campus, you know? And so we have to be able to learn how to debate and respect one another, but still work on these issues respectfully, and then come to a mutual decision between us going forward. But I think that we've almost lost that ability to have debate. And so now everybody's in their corners and not communicating. That's the only answer that we have.
And, you know, one thing that I realized a while ago, I was sitting at the airport in Los Angeles, big airport, passing thousands and thousands of people in this place. Mm. And I was looking around at all these different ages and races and all this melting pot of people. And I was looking specifically at random people. And I realized every single person there could teach me something. Every single person there, a five-year-old could teach me something, right? And something valuable, life lessons. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I want to really help people be more curious, right? Help people understand that, you know what, we're all in this together, folks, right? And be curious and listen to people. And it's okay to disagree, right? Yeah. You can agree to disagree. It's totally fine. And so I love that about the fraternities and the sororities. Yeah. And I hope they will continue that spirit.
Yeah, I hope so too. I really, believe me, more than you know, I hope that they will continue that spirit as well. Well, let's talk about it. Let's get into the history, because, you know, you mentioned American concentration camps before. And I think a lot of people that maybe aren't aware of history, they immediately, their antennas went up and said, what do you mean? This is happening in America, in the United States of America? So let's talk about it. On December 7th, 1941, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. Yep. The United States gets into World War II. Now you have President Roosevelt, who signs Executive Order 9066, which allowed the U.S. Army to imprison Japanese American citizens in concentration camps. So why did you decide to write about the story of Shiro Cash Kashino in your book? It's called American Grit: From a Japanese American Concentration Camp Rises an American War Hero. Why'd you write that book?
Well, you know what? You kind of said it at the beginning, because nobody knows about this stuff. And fewer people, like you said, when people's ears go up when I talk about concentration camps in America that that incarcerated 50,000 American children during World War II. And they go, wait, what? What? This is actually a true story. And it's an extraordinary true story. And out of those concentration camps were thousands of men like this gentleman, Shiro, his nickname is Cash, but Shiro Kashino, who volunteered out of those camps to fight and die for the United States Army, who put them and their families in those camps to begin with. And they still, their families were still in those camps while they went off to fight, guarded by the United States Army. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. And so, you know, I wrote this to inform the world. And as we were talking about, to educate. And, you know, there's books about the about the concentration camps and stuff like that. I think one of the things I realized is that we have to present it in different ways, you know. And so I present the entire experience of the American concentration camps and these men who went off to fight and die for the United States Army through the story of Shiro Kashino, who volunteered out of the Minidoka concentration camp in Idaho. And by the way, there were 10 of these things scattered across the country that jailed 122,000 people and evicted and evacuated them from the West Coast because of their race. And so, you know, it's just an amazing, amazing story. And Shiro, he volunteered out of a camp. He joined the segregated Japanese American war unit called the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, this team went on to become the most decorated war unit in the history of the United States for its size of duration and duration. And Shiro Kashino came out being one of the most decorated war heroes of World War II with six Purple Hearts. It's just crazy. I mean, he got blown up six times and kept going back, you know, to fight with his men. So it's an incredible story, right? And it's a true story. And it's a story that the world needs to hear. And that's why I call it American Grit, mm-hmm. because of what they did to prove their loyalty and what they did after the war. Which of itself is an amazing testament to American Grit. Yeah.
So clarify this for me, because mm-hmm. here you're talking about concentration camps for Japanese American citizens. And then suddenly now you're talking about the most hated Americans at that moment because of the bombing. How were they now chosen out of concentration camps to ultimately defeat America's enemies? I mean, the story is wild.
It's totally crazy. So when Executive Order 9066, the executive order that authorized the army to evacuate and jail everybody, mm-hmm. when that happened, there was widespread fear on the West Coast of Japanese spies and that the Japanese were going to attack the West Coast. And so there was a prevailing feeling that if you look like the enemy, if you look Japanese, you must be the enemy. And so they rounded up, including babies and children, as I mentioned to you, right? And so these guys, what happened was that the guys out of the camps volunteered. They volunteered to join the United States Army to prove their loyalty. Uh-huh. And so what happened was that they went on to fight in Europe and Japan. And in Europe, they were involved with two of the most epic battles of all time. And in the first battle, they lost 80% of the regiment. 80%. They lost almost 1,000 guys to save 200 guys from Texas. And they had another battle in Italy, which the Fifth Army, just real quickly, the Fifth Army, which was 200,000 men, for 6 months, couldn't successfully break through a mountain range in Italy called the Apennine Mountain Range. And they had to break through that mountain range in order to get through to Germany. And so what they couldn't do in 6 months, the 442nd came in, they brought in the 442nd, and they did within 48 hours. And I write about this in my book, but you know, they never lost a battle. They never lost a battle, and they refused. I mean, like I said, most of the guys died. And so they came out of the war, and eventually the unit itself got a Congressional Gold Medal. All the Japanese Americans who fought during World War II were recognized with a Congressional Gold Medal. In the Japanese theater, there were 5,000 guys, and I don't talk about the Japanese, the theater in the Pacific, but there are 5,000 Japanese American men who joined the United States Army to fight against Japan. And they served as code breakers, interpreters, negotiators. My dad was one of them. And the amazing thing about that was that at the time, Japan viewed anybody in outside of Japan as being Japanese citizens. And if these guys were captured by the Japanese Army or Navy, they were shot for being a traitor. So these guys had to deal with that. And they had to deal with having bodyguards in the United States Army so that our Army wouldn't mistake them as a Japanese enemy as they fought against Japan. It's just crazy, crazy stuff. And it's something that is just really inspiring, honestly. And it's a story that very few people know about.
Wow, this is really mind-blowing. I'm sure a lot of students, they're hearing about this for the first time as you're speaking.
Yeah.
And so, all right, so you told us about the battles, and you know, you kind of talked about the recognition that the United States military gave to these Japanese American citizens for serving. But what was the aftermath of all of this in terms of the families that were in the concentration camps? And, you know, where do we go from here? You know, I guess what happens after?
Yeah. So I mentioned that Congressional Gold Medal that came almost 50 years after the end of the war. It took that long to recognize these guys.
50 years is a long time.
50 years, right. And so what happened immediately when they came back, they were actually recognized with a parade down through Washington, D.C., and they were recognized by President Truman. So the President of the United States, President Roosevelt had died, as you know, but Truman recognized them as being incredible Americans. Not that long after that, a guy named Daniel Inouye, who later served in the United States Senate for 49 years, and he was a Medal of Honor recipient for what he did in World War II. But as he was heading back from the war, he walked into a barbershop, and the barber said, "You need to read that sign on the wall." And the sign said, "We don't cut Jap hair." He was wearing his American uniform, lost his right arm. And that's what the sentiment was like. Even though President Truman had recognized these guys, right? The rest of the country still viewed them very, very negatively as, if you will, Japs. And so immediately after the war, it was really, really hard for these folks in the camps. They released everybody from the camps, and they said, "Hey, look, here's $25 and a one-way bus ticket anywhere, wherever you want to go to start your lives all over again." And you have to understand that when they were incarcerated, they lost everything. A lot of people lost everything. They lost their farms. They lost their businesses. They lost their homes. They lost all their belongings. And now all of a sudden they were told, "All right, have a nice day. Here's $25, right? So when they came back, and they some people that didn't go back to the West Coast because they just didn't want to deal with it, but a lot of people did. Wherever they went, though, they had trouble finding housing. Nobody wanted to house them. They had trouble finding jobs. And here's the thing: as much as they were hated and reviled during and before the war, in a lot of ways, they were viewed even worse because now they were the enemy that lost, right? And even, you know, amazingly, the guys in Seattle came home and they wanted to join the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the VFW, right? Mm-hmm. It's for veterans. Mm-hmm. They were refused because they were Japanese. These guys, these guys. guys were the most decorated war part of the decorate most decorated war unit in World War II, and the VFW wouldn't accept them. So they went off and created their own clubs, you know, for Japanese Americans. And so for decades, it was hard. But over time, you know, they never gave up on their American dream of a better life for their families. They didn't want to go back to Japan, right? And they stuck through it. And that's where part of the story of American grit is everything that they did, and they won. They won. They made a much better life for themselves.
Mm-hmm. You know, you made some really good points earlier, kind of comparing it to the Muslim Americans and what they felt after the World Trade Center bombing.
Right.
You mentioned Chinese Americans and what they felt after the pandemic and, you know, blaming China for releasing this. And you actually believe that American concentration camps are our future, which to me is just so scary, because I always want to talk about my Jewish family's experiences escaping from the German concentration camps in the Holocaust. Right. Because, you know, my family was gutted. And if it wasn't for two people escaping the concentration camps, I'm not here today. And I don't want us to ever repeat that history. So what do we need to do in order to stop these concentration camps from happening again?
Well, you know, the a couple of things on what you just said, right? Absent us stemming the current tide, they will happen again. That's why I'm doing this, right? I don't want it to happen again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's we use the words concentration camp, both for the American experience and the European Holocaust experience. Mm-hmm. The experiences obviously were different, right? Because the United States didn't purposely kill people in our concentration camps, but they were concentration camps nonetheless. And you look at any definition, it talks about large numbers of people, you know, oftentimes persecuted minorities, imprisoned deliberately in a relatively small area with inadequate facilities. That's a concentration camp, right? Mm-hmm. But the European experience obviously was so, so terrible. But I do believe that if the vitriol and the impatience and not listening to others and not being curious about other people's viewpoints doesn't get better, something bad's really going to happen. There's no question that something's going to happen that's going to create widespread fear in this country. Mm-hmm. And the only question is, how are we going to respond to it? So what do we need to do about it? So I believe, you know, what I believe needs to happen is not any kind of a tectonic shift in the way we look at the world. It's not something that's going to come down from Congress that says you have to do something. It's going to be little things. It's going to be little things, which is part of the reason why I'm so excited to be talking with your audience. Mm-hmm. You know, things like being responsible for your life. And I know this is one of the things that you teach your audience. Don't be a victim, right? Don't be a victim, because love comes from strength. Fear comes from weakness, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I'll tell you something. Many years ago, I had this dream. I had this dream, this recurring dream, that some big guy would grab me and he would push me up against a wall and I couldn't move. I couldn't move. There was nothing I could do. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I learned martial arts, right? And 25 years later, I'm a 5th-degree black belt. I never have that dream again, right? It just doesn't happen. I've never had to use it or anything. But, you know, I mean, when you learn to take responsibility and face those fears, all of a sudden it you have control. It's a most wonderful thing to be able to say, you know what, my life is the result of the decisions that I've made. Stop blaming somebody else for it, mm-hmm. right? And take responsibility for it. And the other part of it is learning to live with gratitude. Learning to live with the gratitude that we do live in a crazy great country. It you know, it may not be the greatest in all ways, but Tom Brady was the greatest of all time, right? I mean, did he make a really great linebacker? No, right? Yeah, he played one position, and that still made him the greatest of all time. And so, you know, and one way to live with gratitude that's really, really simple that you, everybody's going to be able to do right now is what I call got to get. Change the word got to get, right? Instead of saying, I got to go to class, I get to go to class, right? I got to go to work, I get to go to work. Because you know what? I mean, all this stuff is a privilege, right? Going to school is a privilege. Going to work is a privilege. I got to get up. I get to get up. That's a real privilege, right? For me, I get to get up in the morning and I'm able to wake up. And so if you just change those two words in your life, you'll see a shift. You will see an instant shift. You probably felt it just when I said it, right? Yeah. And so it's not huge things that need to happen. I'm not telling people that you have to change the way you do business. You know, one thing I have always, and I've heard this come back to me, and people have said, John, I love what you said about this thing. I raised my kids to always take care of the little ones. Always take care of the little ones. It's really easy to hang out with the big guys, the cool people, right? The bosses and all that kind of stuff. But I tell my kids their job is to take care of the people who are being bullied. You know, take care of the people who are insecure. Take care of the fraternity and sorority world, right? Taking care of the folks who are just coming in, right? Yeah, the pledges. Yeah, take care of them, right? Mm-hmm. And I get the hazing thing and stuff like that, but take care of them. And so if we do that, if we do little things like that, we'll lift the world. And if you just live in with an attitude of gratitude and take control of your life and understand it's a wonderful thing, because now you can set a whole different chain of decisions moving forward that will change your life. Your decisions direct your life.
Mm-hmm. I like that a lot. I get to go to college. I'm in a doctorate. I'm in a doctorate program, and I consider myself very lucky to be able to be in a doctorate program. And I think to the college students who are listening right now, undergraduate level too, you have enormous privilege going to an institution of higher education.
Absolutely. Okay?
Not everybody gets that opportunity in this world. All right. And so I do think that we have an obligation as fraternity and sorority members to leave our communities better than we found it, because ultimately we have privilege, and you have to understand the privilege and the responsibility that goes with that to make your community better, not just to take, but to give.
Exactly.
That's exactly. Really, really important. You talk about, you know, these, the concentration camps, you know, interestingly enough, you know, in the United States, I think they call it internment camps.
Right.
You know, maybe that sounds better. You know, I don't know if there's necessarily a difference between the two, but how do we live in a society of less fear and more love for our children's sake?
Well, you know, I tell people all the time that when I grow up, I want to be like my kids, right? And, you know, it goes back to the little things, just little things, making little shifts in your life. You know, be the person you want your kids to be. Be that person, right? And guess what? Your kids will be like that, right? And so will you. And so, you know, one of the things I tell people, as much as I respected my dad, and he fought against the Japanese in World War II and all that kind of stuff, there are so many things about him that I did not want to have in my life, that I just refused to make part of my life, and I refused to make part of raising my children. And so, you know, be the person, figure out who that person is, and go be that person, because when you're that person, you're gonna lift yourself, and you're gonna lift the world at the same time. And learn about other people's perspective. Learn about what's happening. Don't whitewash. You know, this whole thing about whitewashing. To me, don't cancel our history. Learn from it, because history forgotten or history ignored is going to happen again. And so the whole idea is to understand what happened, and just, you know what, if it starts coming back up again, get in front of it. Help me get in front of it, right? Because Bad stuff like this doesn't raise anybody. It just makes everything worse.
Really well said. I love this book that you wrote about Cash, also known as Shiro Kishino, called American Grit: From a Japanese American Concentration Camp Rises an American War Hero. What was the response that you've received from your book so far?
You know, it's amazing. It's amazing. It's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. I read the reviews and stuff like that. And I haven't gotten a 4-star yet. It's all been 5 stars. and so the response, you know, largely has been, oh my God, I didn't have a clue about all this stuff. And other people said, hey, I knew about the concentration camps and I knew about the Japanese Americans going to war, but I didn't know this stuff. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, but it's an Amazon bestseller. And so, and to be honest with you, I was concerned. I purposely used the words concentration camp on it.
Yeah.
Right. Because some people had told me, well, you know, that has to do with the Holocaust, but, right. You know, talking to the folks, that I interviewed, they hated the term internment camp. They hated the term relocation camp. They were euphemisms. They had their civil liberties taken away. I mean, it was the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional many years afterwards. Mm. And so, but the response has been wonderful because people are learning from it.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm looking for.
I mean, did we use internment camps just to make people feel better? So basically, is that why we use that terminology versus a concentration camp?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a euphemism.
It's a euphemism. Huh?
And they use relocation camps, which is even worse.
It's even worse than internment camp.
And now here's the fact of the matter. They are all the same thing. The concentration camps are internment camps, are relocation camps. Mm-hmm. But I'm calling it like it is.
Yeah, well, that is pretty brave for you to call it like it is, because, you know, if you look it up online, like I said, you'll just see internment camp. I mean, that's the terminology that's most commonly used. But it is interesting that you chose that for your title, because you're really saying, hey, I'm calling a spade a spade. I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah.
We can't, you know, basically try to make it seem better or not talk about it. This is a part of American history.
Well, the name of the book is American Grit. And so I just, if I'm going to talk about it, I better do it.
Yeah.
Right?
You better go all in.
Step up. Did. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. This is just incredible. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this. I think this is fantastic. I know that you live out in the Seattle area. I'm going to be going out to, I'm speaking in Washington this month at Washington State. So I'm going to be on the West Coast. I'm going to be pretty close to Seattle. So, you know, the next time I get out to the Seattle area, where should I be going for a great meal?
Well, I don't know if I'm the right guy to ask that question because your listeners are going to love it because I'm a very budget-minded man.
Perfect. Our listeners love that. That's exactly what they're looking for.
And so this might be a little, I'm going to give you two recommendations. First place is a donut shop. It's called Top Pot Donuts. And the original store is in Seattle. So if you have a chance to go there, it's amazing. The other restaurant, which is one of my absolute favorites, is a Japanese family restaurant, and it's called Maneki, as in the Maneki Neko, you know, the little white cat that's like this in the front of Japanese stores. Sure. So Maneki, and it's Japanese comfort food. And so if you're into just a family restaurant, to go to really great food, go to Maneki. It's wonderful.
That's a perfect recommendation. You know, we got college students that are living on a budget, so they're going to head right over there and they're going to go and check it out. I love the Japanese comfort food. It's one of my favorite type of cuisine. So for me, that's a big bonus. So next time I'm in Seattle, I'll go check it out. I'll let you know what I think.
Awesome. Wonderful. Yep.
It's really, really good. I love it. All right. So if our listeners, if they want to go and buy your book, or maybe they want to bring you in to speak on their college campus about the Japanese Americans during World War II, where should they go to connect with you?
Oh my gosh, I would be honored with both. So they can go to johnsuzuki.com and everything is there. And as for buying the book, it's in a lot of bookstores and certainly on Amazon. So you can go there and learn about it. But I'd be honored if you read the book, and I'd be certainly honored to come and visit you guys.
Well, that's fantastic. All right, it's johnsuzuki.com. Go and pick up the book on Amazon. It's called American Grit: From a Japanese-American Concentration Camp Rises an American War Hero. This book is all about Shiro, also known as Cash Kashino. Just an incredible, incredible story that, you know, they just don't teach in school. So I'm super happy that you took the time to write the book and get it out to the masses and tell people about it, so that way we don't repeat some of these things that happened throughout our history here in America, certainly all over the world. We don't want to see these kinds of things happening. So thank you for writing the book, and thank you for being a guest on the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael. It is a total honor for me. Thank you.
Fantastic. And to our listeners, if you enjoyed this conversation with John, make sure that you like it on social media. Make sure that you share it with other college students that maybe didn't know about this part of American history. And we hope to see you on another episode of the Fraternity Foodie Podcast. Thanks so much for joining us, and we're going to see you next time.